Welcome to the History of Chemistry podcast. I'm Steve Cohen, your host, and this is episode 9, The First Chemists, or Chymists. In this episode, we shall discuss the very beginnings of actual chemistry. Thanks to those who already support this podcast. Support the continuation of this podcast at Patreon. The website is www.patreon.com/thehistoryofchemistry. We left off in the last episode as the long-practiced field of alchemy entered a decline, while true science began to be practiced simultaneously. The first person of note at this point was Angelo Sala, a doctor and experimental chemist born in Italy in 1576. In 1614, he examined silver salts, particularly silver nitrate, and was the first person to note that silver nitrate turned black in sunlight. You may have been told of this if you have been in a freshman chemistry laboratory working with silver nitrate and gotten some of this chemical on your hands. Sala's colleagues, however, dismissed this observation as of no value. It took more than 2 centuries for this effect to find a practical value, eventually ending up as the photosensitive material in photographic plates in the 1820s. Another experiment was the first attempt at a chemical synthesis confirmed by chemical analysis. Sala wanted to determine what blue vitriolum is and out of what kind of pieces or materials it is composed or put together by nature. We now call blue vitriol copper sulfate hexahydrate, based on its composition, which was unknown then. And even the naming scheme wasn't invented until 150 years later. At this time, chemicals' names were distinguished by their source and properties. Sala was able to distill out of blue vitriol first water and then sulfur-bearing vapor, with the residue left behind as a reddish-brown substance similar to burned copper, what we now call copper II oxide. Remarkably, Sala also commented that water, sulfur-bearing vapor, and copper ore can exist in combination only in their appropriate proportion. He found that, after he distilled off the water, the residue cannot weigh more than 2/3 with respect to the previous weight of the raw vitriol. We now know that the coppery residue comprises 64%. Here is one more of Sala's experiments. He noted that when you put an iron nail in a blue vitriol solution, copper metal appears on the nail. Where did that copper come from? Sala thought the blue vitriol contained copper somehow. Likewise, when you put a copper coin into a silver nitrate solution, silver grows on the coin. So then silver nitrate, ignoring the modern name, contains silver? And similarly, place mercury on the bottom of a glass beaker and cover the mercury with a silver nitrate solution. Silver needles grow on the mercury. The question is then, how could a four-element theory or three principles explain this? Rather, Sala thought, the metals retain their identity somehow in the solutions. Likewise, Jean Béguin, by 1615, began to consider that chemicals remained somehow part of both reactants and products. He heated corrosive sublimate, mercury II chloride in modern terms, together with stibnite, antimony trisulfide, and obtained cinnabar, mercuric sulfide, with butter of antimony, antimony trichloride. Essentially, he performed and recognized that the components switch around with each other, what modern chemists call a double displacement reaction. In fact, he wrote the first chemical equation for this process. In the last episode, I briefly mentioned Jan Baptista van Helmont of Flanders, a contemporary of Sala, who performed probably the first biochemical experiment by weighing dirt and a baby tree, watering the tree, and weighing the adult tree years later. Van Helmont also distinguished himself by researching air, or more exactly, airs, plural. Everyone knew about the air all around them, from the wind blowing and animals breathing, but there was no understanding about the components of air because, well, air was an element like fire or water. That said, Alchemists had some experience with various airs and vapors they distilled off of chemicals, although these vapors were ill understood. There was no way to capture and observe them, and they were easy to ignore or dismiss as unimportant. They were, however, regarded as mysterious, and so were called spirits, analogous to supernatural ghosts and spirits, as I also mentioned earlier. Perhaps you have heard of spirits of turpentine and spirits of alcohol. So the first person we know of to carefully study these vapors, spirits, or airs was Jan Baptista van Helmont. He decided that these airs were like the original primal disordered material in mythology that the ancient Greeks called chaos. In English, we say chaos, but in Flemish, it sounds more like chaos. In Dutch and Flemish, the letter G is pronounced ch, and so van Helmont called it chaos, G-A-S. To us English speakers, it looks like gas, and that's the word we have today. The gas van Helmont studied was created when wood and charcoal burned. He called it gas sylvestre, from French meaning of the forest. He also found it was the same gas as that produced by must undergoing fermentation, which is young wine. As we look at the chemistry of the 17th and 18th centuries, we will return again and again to the theme of gases, which were a popular focus of research of that era. If you have studied physics, you may have heard of Galileo, who studied falling objects in Italy in the 1590s. One of Galileo's students later in life was Evangelista Torricelli. Torricelli also worked with gases. Perhaps his most famous invention was the barometer in 1643. He did this by filling a meter-long tube with mercury and inverting it into a bowl. The mercury sagged into the bowl, leaving an empty space above the upward-pointing sealed end of the tube. This empty space is the first deliberately made vacuum, which again contradicted the Aristotelian view that a vacuum is impossible. The result is that we know that air pushes down on everything with a pressure corresponding to a height of about 76 centimeters of mercury, the approximate height of the mercury in the tube that Torricelli found. Torricelli discovered that gases and airs were substances, not just an evanescent spirit. Torricelli summed it up nicely by saying, "We live submerged at the bottom of an ocean of the element air, which by unquestioned experiments is known to have weight." Notice that he called air an element. Aristotle's four-element theory still ruled the day. There was no viable alternative. The pressure of air in the Earth's atmosphere was found to be extremely large, as the German natural philosopher Otto von Guericke showed dramatically in 1654. He devised two copper hemispheres that could be sealed together to make a hollow ball of copper, and then invented a pump to suck out the air from inside. A team of horses attached to each half of the copper ball was unable to pull the ball apart. All this news of gas and air and such reached Great Britain, and in particular an Irish scientist named Robert Boyle. He, working with Robert Hooke, devised his own pumping system to pull air out of a chamber. And then he tried a new method, pushing more air into a chamber. He ran quantitative experiments, that is, they showed a mathematical relationship that the volume of air in the chamber was inversely proportional to its pressure in the chamber. Or, we can say, the more he pushed on the air, the smaller it got. He squeezed the air into a J-shaped glass tube sealed at the small end of the J, and trapped it inside the small end with a blob of mercury. The more mercury he added, increasing the weight, the smaller volume the air was forced into. They published the results in 1662, and this mathematical relationship is now called Boyle's Law. To be clear, there is no chemical change involved here. The air remained air, just compressed or expanded. Because this was a physical change, this is an example of a branch of chemistry called physical chemistry, which we will encounter much more in the 19th century. There was another factor Boyle ignored, the temperature of the air. You may already know that automobile tire pressure is higher on hot days, and tires can sag on extremely cold days. This was quantified by the French scientist Edme Mariotte in 1680. Why this effect occurs would have to wait till the kinetic theory of gases was formulated in the 19th century. Mariot, by the way, was one of the initial members of the French Royal Academy of Sciences. But let's consider gases as matter along with the provable existence of a vacuum. If we can expand or contract gases at will, but they are material objects just like solids or liquids, what scientists now call condensed matter, then the case for atoms is far more reasonable. For you can imagine tiny atoms with empty spaces between them. If you compress the gas, the empty space shrinks, and if you expand a gas, the empty space grows. With this view, you can also explain liquids that evaporate. With atomic liquids, various atoms gradually drift away from the liquid, leaving less and less liquid behind. And then you can argue that water is made of water atoms, whether it's steam, in a gaseous form, liquid, with atoms sliding around, and ice, with atoms frozen in place. All of a sudden, Boyle and a whole lot of scientists return to a more modern form of the ancient Greek Democritus's atomic theory. Atomism became much more popular in the second half of the 17th century. Of course, there was no way to explain exactly what an atom was, or what might keep atoms together in liquids or solids. That would have to wait, and so shall we. What was truly amazing was that two experiments, just two, from Torricelli and Boyle, tilted the scales of evidence on the internal fine composition of matter from neutral, basically philosophers arguing it out for or against atoms with no clear answer, to atomism. In all of 2,000 years of yammering on and getting nowhere, finally actual evidence confirmed something. This was the effect that science, and ultimately Francis Bacon's views a generation or so earlier, had. It was yet another nail in the coffin of Aristotelianism. We should note that just around this time, Antonie van Leeuwenhoek from Holland made an improved microscope and discovered microorganisms, or animalcules as was popular to call them. This opened a whole new world of ultimately small things to ponder. Why not even tinier objects like atoms? The scientific community was primed in a way to accept atomism now. Let's continue a bit with Robert Boyle. One of his most important books he wrote in 1661, called The Skeptical Chemist, or Chemico-Physical Doubts and Paradoxes. The title and language of the book itself was revolutionary, for it was not in Latin, but English. Generally, the local vernacular language was intended for tradesmen and artisans, not for scholars. Second, the word chemist was used, the first time the practitioner of the chemical science was called so in English. Here we talk a bit about the title of this episode, chemist with a Y or an E. As I mentioned in the previous episode, Agricola, over a century earlier, dropped the al prefix and used chemistry instead of alchemy. The spelling, though, was with C-H-Y, not C-H-E. On the title page of his book, he also spelled alchemists with a C-H-Y, as was common at the time. The transition to C-H-E for alchemy and chemistry occurred in the early 1700s, based on a more careful rendition of the ancient Greek spelling, a bit later in our story, around the time that alchemy and chemistry separated unequivocally from each other. At our present point in the history of chemistry, the latter half of the 1600s, we are in a transition period. Both chemistry and alchemy were still being practiced simultaneously, often by the same people, and often confused with each other. Many historians of science today use the term with C-H-Y, chemistry, to describe this transition period. Let's look at the arguments in Boyle's book. One theme is atomism, which we have seen gaining adherence based on the new experiments with air. But another theme is explicit and clear rejection of Aristotelian four-element theory, along with the medieval three principles of salt, sulfur, and mercury. Some examples. We already know about a burning green stick to give off so-called four elements of earth, air, fire, and water. But what about decomposing blood into its parts? Boyle said that blood gives off more than four: phlegm, spirit, oil, salt, and earth. That doesn't follow four-element theory. And you can burn wood in two different ways to get two different results. Burning wood over an open grate gives ash plus soot. Burning wood in a closed vessel gives ash, oil, spirit, vinegar, water, and charcoal. How can four elements explain this? Instead, he defines the word element in the following way. I now mean by elements as those chemists that speak plainest do by their principles, certain primitive and simple or perfectly unmingled bodies, which not being made of any other bodies or of one another, are the ingredients of all those called perfectly mixed bodies, are immediately compounded, and into which they are ultimately resolved. In more modern words, Boyle says that an element is a substance that cannot be separated into other substances. It is an easy and somewhat slippery definition because it leaves open the possibility that some chemist in the future, using currently unknown methods, can resolve that element into other simple substances. Boyle said that chemists must try to disassemble compounds as far as they can into their elements, however well current chemistry can, and then reassemble them. The designation of some substance as an element is necessarily a temporary label. Here we have a working definition for element that became the standard for 250 years. Boyle made a practical definition of acids and bases as well. To decide if something was an acid, he added it to a solution called syrup of violets. This was a cooked syrup of violets and sugar in water, and the color changed to red. Another characteristic of an acid is a sour taste. To decide if something was basic, he added it to a solution of syrup of lilacs. That is a cooked syrup of lilacs and sugar in water, and the color changed to green. Another characteristic of bases is they taste bitter, and a third one is that bases feel slippery like soap. Now, this definition by taste was a popular one for chemists up until the 20th century and was very dangerous. Likely you know that one never tastes anything in a modern chemistry laboratory. But his uses of vegetable dyes as color indicators and taste were the standard until the development of pH meters and fancy indicator papers in the past century. I did mention that this century was a transition time from alchemy to chemistry, and that both fields were simultaneously practiced. So, for example, Robert Boyle himself was a believer in transmutation. Neither atomism nor a new definition of element clearly refuted transmutation of cheap metals into gold. Isaac Newton was also a part-time alchemist. And there was Hennig Brandt. Hennig Brandt, born around 1630, lived in Hamburg, Germany. As an alchemist, he was obsessed with finding the Philosopher's Stone. His first wife died, and he spent all her money on this pursuit, and then married again to a wealthy widow whose fortune allowed him to continue alchemical work. One alchemical process in 1669 occurred when he was heating gunk left over from boiled down urine in a retort, a container with a long narrow spout that points downward. The retort was getting hot enough to turn red when suddenly glowing vapors inside caused liquid to drip out of the spout and catch fire. Brandt caught this liquid, which hardened as it cooled, and glowed in the dark with a faint greenish color. He named this white solid Phosphorus Mirabilis, for miraculous bearer of light. Phosphorus was the first actual element, zinc is debatable, and to use Boyle's definition, discovered since ancient times. What we usually don't hear about in the discovery story, though, is how much urine Brandt had to collect, and the awful smell he must have had in his laboratory.
Ugh.
The faint glow from the element is now called phosphorescence, and is a different physical process than fluorescence, which occurs under the direct influence of light, such as day glow paints or the blue glow of white cloth under ultraviolet illumination. The actual mechanisms of phosphorescence and fluorescence were not understood till the internal structure of the atom and quantum mechanics were elucidated in the 20th century. In this episode, we have looked at the transition century of the 1600s, when alchemy began to yield to the science of chemistry, and the work of some early chemists worthy of the title, up to the groundbreaking work of Robert Boyle. In our next episode, we'll hear more about gases and fire, and a popular idea about burning, the phlogiston theory. Until then, brave the elements! Thank you for listening to the History of Chemistry podcast.